The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, it's a pleasure to welcome Grace Boland, newly elected TD in Fingal West, although I call it Fingal North, for Fine Gael, following in the pedigree of John Boland back in my day. Yes, I am that old. And welcoming back to the Dáil, in Dublin West, of course, Ruth Coppinger, TD for People Before Profit Solidarity. Also with us is Sarah McGuinness, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. She didn't make it to Washington with a Nordic Craig, because I was speaking to him. And last but by no means least, Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at the University of Galway and columnist with the Journal. .ie. So, Larry, let's start with you as half American, half Irish. You know, the issue was, after Zelensky got a roasting and was kicked out of the White House, that, you know, this has turned into almost a 50-minute reality show with Ask the Audience questions, and they're the most difficult questions. I thought that Micheál, it was a tough gig. There was bits of it I personally found uncomfortable, whereas when he was doing the Shamrock and the set speech, you know, the giving of the Shamrock, he was back on old territory speaking about the Irish history and diaspora and all their trade relations and so on. How do you think it went for Ireland?
Well, I think on the day, I mean, you know, he really was in the bear pit. And of course, we had all seen what happened with Zelensky a couple of weeks earlier. I think the key thing was that obviously from the get-go, J.D. Vance and Donald Trump were in a very different mood. Ireland was not in their firing line. They were not on a war footing. In terms of how he comported himself at the media visibility, which goes on for ages now, unlike in the old days, I think he did reasonably well under the circumstances. He emerged relatively unscathed. I think he made a couple of important points. The idea of a two-way street, I think, was an important point to make. There will be, of course, and I know Ruth will be one of them, critics who say that he didn't do anything near enough to express the sentiments of the Irish people when it comes to Gaza, when it comes to Ukraine. Perhaps he didn't stand up robustly enough for the European Union. But from a realpolitik point of view, I keep coming back to the following question, which is, what possible good would refuting President Trump when he's in full flow, when he's performing for a domestic audience, what possible good could come of Micheál Martin refuting him in any respect for Ireland, for Europe, or even more importantly, for the people in Gaza, Ukraine, or anywhere else? So I think under the circumstances, I think he performed well. That having been said, you asked the question about for Ireland. The reality is Ireland still remains exposed. Ireland is still in the firing line. We see this with tariffs that have been mooted. So there's a long road ahead. But in terms of the day itself, it went pretty well under the circumstances.
Ruth Coppinger, I noticed you and your colleagues in People for Profit said that maybe he was almost subservient. What's your take on it?
Yeah, well, I think no possible good could have come from the meeting. I think he shouldn't have gone. I think we should not be normalising what's happening with Donald Trump and with the US and with the world in general, whereby he's announced his intention to ethnically cleanse Gaza for real estate profiteering. He's, you know, been assertive, or rather abusive towards Greenland. He's got his sights set, even on Ukraine, for mineral wealth, for material, naked imperialism, basically, where he strong-armed them into doing a deal for his interests. And also within the US, by the way, he's attacking workers. He's attacking trans people. He wants to erase trans people. He's misogynistic. He's a sexual predator. The list is absolutely endless. You know, we've had the taking away of a green card of somebody who protested in a college campus, which thankfully is getting a response of tens of thousands of people for Mahmoud Khalil. So we've had fascist salutes. Are we going to pretend that none of this actually is happening? And I think that's what I saw in the meeting was subservience.
What but would also, you say to a farmer worker in Pfizer or Johnson & Johnson, be it in Cork and so on, who would feel that a bit of sucking up wouldn't go astray to protect their jobs? What do you say to them?
Well, the first thing I'd say is just don't gaslight us about what's happening with Donald Trump, right? Like, if you made a decision to go, well, then go, but then don't pretend that you did something. So look what Micheál Martin said. An unrelenting focus on peace, Donald Trump. The people of Gaza were starving during Ramadan while he was making this point. Unrelenting focus on peace for Ukraine. It's a peace that will be enforced for his interest. And then he went on to say, we want the hostages out. So he didn't represent the people of this country in relation to Gaza in any way. He also then went on, as we saw, to joke about the housing crisis, which, you know, I know we'll be discussing separately. And he laughed or went on to make a joke when Trump picked his favourite Irish person.
You're saying he'd be better not to have gone at all?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
OK, Sarah McGuinness, working in the media, Irish Daily Mail, what was your take on it?
Yeah, it was slightly surreal to watch this kind of 50-minute spectacle unfold. And it was really interesting, actually, from the beginning. There was kind of looking at Micheál Martin. He didn't appear as he usually appears. So Micheál Martin is quite tall. He's 6'1", usually standing very tall, very upright. He's so health conscious, like fantastic posture, walks every day, for an hour, and that's kind of where he does like his main business calls. But when the camera started rolling, he was actually hunched forward in his chair. He scooted to the forward in his chair and sat the exact same way as Donald Trump did, and nearly mirrored a lot of his movements for the first like 10, 15 minutes at least. I think it was just really interesting seeing someone who in Irish politics has been like, whether you like him or not, a very formidable character, you know.
I described like Finn Harps going to Anfield.
Yeah.
It was in a way gig, you know.
And you could kind of tell from the outset that that was the atmosphere. And so much of it, like that, the laughing about the housing, the kind of joking around the housing crisis.
It was kind of nervous laughter.
Nervous laughter, and it was taking cues from other people in the room.
And sometimes he couldn't get his word in even, like he was kind of interrupted.
He was. And like, I suppose, like, I don't think anyone thought that Micheál Martin was going to be the one to go into the Oval Office and stand up to Trump. Because realistically, I don't think... Not that it can be him, but it has to come from von der Leyen. It has to come from Ursula von der Leyen.
I don't know if you saw this morning, there's photos of Marco Rutte, the NATO guy, and just the way he was holding, he was much more relaxed and it was almost like he was running the show. But like the whole format of this reality TV show is the King Caractacus there is the centre, like everyone is playing to his court.
Absolutely. And even any time Micheál Martin wanted to get a word in, he'd nearly have to tap Donald Trump to be able to speak. And even the questions that he was being thrown, the journalist's name escapes me, but he was the same man who asked Zelensky about his outfit. He was the one who asked about Rosie O'Donnell and why the comedian said she was moving to Ireland to escape Trump. And there was kind of a joking question about if Ireland is such a happy land, why are we accepting Rosie O'Donnell?
It's a real Republican thing.
It was a real Republican thing. But like, it kind of, you know, like some of the questions he was getting wasn't even that serious. Everyone wanted to talk to Trump.
And it's for a US audience, really.
It's for a US audience completely. And even it was kind of interesting, like on the Wednesday morning, looking at the front pages or even just the papers of the New York Times, the Washington Post, we got like there was a small mention in the Washington Post of
just
the
before
meeting.
I go on to Grace, Ireland's newest crime family, the Burkes, were there.
They were, yes, they were. It was kind of surprising. They were kind of laying low for the first 24 hours.
They kicked off in the fund.
But they kicked off last night and, as per usual, were dragged out kicking and screaming. And
which is what they want.
Yeah, and their fan base love it. Their fan base admired them for it. You know, it's. I think everyone else is good to see it for what it is. But
Grace Boland, what did you make of it all?
I think the Taoiseach did very well. There was... understandably, I think some nervousness before he went. But people I talked to in the streets out in North County Dublin, when I spoke to them in the shops, and when I listened to political commentators like yourself and Larry, everyone is saying that he did well. He brought up the fact that our trade relationship is a two-way relationship. He brought up the fact that we want to see a two-state solution in Gaza.
Didn't hear him saying that?
He did. He did bring it up. He did, absolutely. Really? And he also... brought up the fact that he had visited the villages attacked by Hamas. So I think he did very well. And look, at St. Patrick's Day is a fantastic opportunity for Ireland to go to so many countries around the world. This year, we had 38 representatives in over 90 cities. And Washington is one of those. It's a very important relationship for us, and the Taoiseach did well.
But was Trump totally disingenuous? Like, you know, I'm very familiar with the drinks industry. You have the whiskey industry, which has grown very rapidly here. You have Diageo and so on. The 200% tariffs would make a bottle of Irish whiskey go from $50 to $150. Now that will, if it happened, like for a guy who says he didn't want to hurt the Irish, he's going about in a peculiar way.
So I think we've a long way to go on tariffs. You know, history has shown us that Trump likes to hop a ball. He likes to use tariffs as a way to open negotiations. And I think, you know, it's in retaliation to the tariffs for the steel. But there's a long way to go here. But
OK, I just want to pivot to one other before we move off of Trump, which is the only thing you could say tariffs and other things are not going well, gas and so on, for him. But one thing that may be going well for him is the prospect of a 30-day ceasefire. There's now agreement between the US in Ukraine, agreement between Zelensky's government and the Trump administration, and it's now over to Russia.
We agree with the proposal that the fighting must end, but it has to be an agreement that leads to a long-term peace that removes the root causes of the crisis.
Larry, you know, to me, I actually support Trump on this because the benefits of peace, you get a 20% reduction in energy costs. You know, the huge military cost is unaffordable. That money maybe has to be taken from health and other things. The body count is becoming really desperate. I don't think either side can win. And so therefore, if it can't go on, it must stop. Someone has to try and stop it. What's your take on where we're at with Ukraine? Or do you think the Russians are just bluffing?
Well, you know, look, it's going to take a while. I think, obviously, Putin feels in Trumpian terms that he has all the cards, so he's going to try to exert every bit of leverage that he has. And I've heard lots of experts, people who know the region very well, talk about what's at play here, talk about the long-term ramifications, talk about what might happen, almost a little bit of morality in foreign policy. The one thing that I want to put forward is that I think I have a pretty good understanding of is Donald Trump's political motivations here. And they are very simple. I think there's a degree of complexity that's being imputed here that is undue. What Donald Trump is after here is a headline that he can trumpet at home that he has brought about a ceasefire in a matter of months where Joe Biden struggled for years and couldn't bring that under control. People say he's giving stuff away in negotiations. He's negotiating in a horrible point of view. That presupposes that Donald Trump is negotiating somehow on behalf of the Ukrainian people, somehow on behalf of Europe. He manifestly is not. He is negotiating solely to get that headline. He doesn't really care much about the terms and conditions of the ceasefire or about what might flow therefrom. He is after that headline.
But that
is what is motivating. And hold on one second. What he is banking on that front is, let's say it breaks down. What he will go back to the American people and say is that, yes, I did everything I possibly could, but what I've also done is I've put it up to Europe. This is a European problem. They need to deal with it.
My question to you is this, if Trump, and he may not succeed, doesn't broker peace, who else will?
Well, that's a very good point. And that will be his, and again, I think he's interested in the Nobel Peace Prize. But what my point keeps coming back to this. Europeans and Americans increasingly see the world very, very differently. Trump is doing all of this for an American audience with a very ad hoc goal in mind. And he is banking on the fact that at the end, even if it all goes pear-shaped in the end, that the American people are going to say that's a European problem.
Ruth, what's your take on the Ukrainian situation as it is right now?
I agree he is doing it for political capital at home, but I think there's a couple of additional things as well. So he definitely does want a deal where there's some sort of compensation, repayment of, you know, the financial aid that the US has pumped in
the minerals
to Ukraine in terms of the mineral wealth. And I think he also wants to do some sort of a deal with Putin that will assist him in terms of his competition with China. I think that definitely is another factor because the US's biggest economic competitor is China, you know, and they do want hegemony in the world and to in any way break a connection between Putin and China is an assist. But let's be clear here, it will definitely assist him. I mean, Biden and so on and the EU couldn't end the situation in Ukraine. So he'll trump that, to use that pun. But he also wants to extract in a very nakedly imperialistic way a deal that benefits him.
So do you think the Russians intimated to Trump that they were up for a ceasefire? Do you think we'll find out if that's true or not?
I don't know. I think it will take some time anyway, because even in the same breath then Vladimir Putin came back and asked all these delaying questions and put down these kind of ridiculous conditions of what he would need for a ceasefire. And a lot of it seems to be happening behind closed doors. So the Ukrainian envoy to the US, whose name escapes me now, but he flew over to Moscow.
Volkov.
Yesterday. Yeah. He flew over to Moscow yesterday. And nobody even knew if he met with Putin or not in the end. Usually those things are kind of done in like a very kind of showmanship way.
And Saudi has hosted some of the talks, you know.
Yeah.
So Rubio and so on.
I think that, you know, there seems to be, while everyone is doing a kind of very softly approach with Donald Trump, like Trump's team kind of seem to be doing the same with Putin. Like it's really fascinating. Putin is the only person who's not bowing to Trump, and he's the one who Trump seems to respect most.
OK, we will go to domestic issues after the break. But Grace, what's your take on the prospects of peace in Ukraine, which obviously for the migrants here, 100,000 people, a lot of them would like to get back to their home country?
We need to see peace in Ukraine. It represents a fundamental threat, not just to Ukraine, but also to European security. We have to do everything we can to work with Europe and to work with the United States to see peace. It was reassuring to hear that they did speak about the real human toll, the real human cost of life of this atrocious war. And we really need to see peace being delivered. And unfortunately, that means we may have to open lines of communication and work with people that are difficult.
All right. After the break, we're going to find out about the water conservation charges that are not going to be, and disturbing figures about the decline in planning permissions for apartments.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
I've an in for Pat this week and next. Our Friday forum is Deputy Grace Boland of Fine Gael, Ruth Coppinger of People Before Profit, Sarah McGuinness, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, and Larry Donnelly, law lecturer in the University of Galway. Now, on Monday, we covered on the programme first item that officials had briefed the new housing minister and the custom house minister, James Brown, to introduce a provision of the 2017 Water Act, whereby if people used excess water, that they would be charged. They'd be entitled to 217,000 litres, and for families an extra 25,000 litres. So it wasn't only in the circumstances where there was excess water to try and encourage conservation. It got a pretty shirty response.
This is the introduction of water charges by the back door. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael always wanted to do this. This is not a charge for so-called excessive use.
They're saying water charges are on the way back, but they're wrong. Fianna Fáil have no plans to bring back water charges, and the minister has confirmed that.
So by Thursday, government's announced there ain't no conservation excess water charge coming in. What did you make of it all, Ruth?
Well, it seems like the idea was floated again of water charges, and then it was quickly dashed down. But what I'd say is this: we all know the movement that took place against the water charges. It was a phenomenally strong protest movement, political movement from below, really. It was the one austerity measure Irish people at the time felt they could defeat, because it was in their hands to pay it or not. And I think the government at the time took a bruising on that, but they left in a sliver to reintroduce it in the future with this excess water thing. And we did warn that at the time. And let's be clear, if that gets in, it won't just be for this so-called profligate use of water. It will then be introduced throughout, as has happened with bin charges. Do you remember we were all told you only pay for what you throw away? And then that was extended to the brown bin and the green bin and all of those other things. So we all know that that would just be an introductory measure. I think they were talking about something that was 1.7 above the average use, which isn't that much, actually. So I think it was an unpopular decision, which they were floating. But I definitely think that the EU wants this and the Irish government wants it. And it actually links in with the whole speaking rights thing, because they will have to bring in unpopular decisions into the future with an economic uncertainty, and they would like to make the Dáil a lot more compliant in that context.
Grace, I mean, I was amazed the short shrift this got, because there was an element of detail to this, because, you know, the 5-year plan with Irish Water is 10 billion. Like, water is not cheap. We're the only country in Europe that doesn't have any charges on householders. Now, whatever about the merits of that, we had a lot of texters to the programme saying, my neighbour has a leaking pipe and is not even reporting it, or people who just leave the taps on, disregarding conservation. Surely it's some merit in pursuing or even debating this issue.
So I was surprised this was a story. It wasn't, water charges weren't included in any of the manifestos of any of the parties in government. It's not included in the programme for government. Funding for Irish Water comes from the Exchequer.
So no issue. And you're delighted the government have retreated from the civil servants' position.
Well, look, it's up to civil servants to provide information, but it's the government who make the decisions, and it's not included in the programme for government. The government is very focused on delivering the programme for government, and water charges isn't included.
A shiver looking for a spine, Sarah?
Well, you see, I think it's interesting because I was not surprised to see this at all, because the government have announced that they have made it very clear that there needs to be drastic investment into infrastructure. Infrastructure is the buzzword of the new coalition. And Jack Chambers said explicitly, when it comes to energy infrastructure, this is going to have to be paid for somehow. Like, he said, we are going to have to invest billions in our energy infrastructure, and we have to pay for it. So that might mean upward pressure on prices for a little while. But in the long term, it's going to mean that we have a better energy infrastructure system, and it's going to mean that prices will eventually come down and be more sustainable. By the sense of it, that's kind of what they're saying about the water system as well. We have a creaking, leaking water infrastructure system, and we can't build more houses until that gets, like, that is feeding the housing crisis. Eventually, it's going to infiltrate every part of life. It's going to infiltrate the health system. You know, like, I'm not surprised at this by this at all, because if their way of thinking about the energy infrastructure system is, well, we're going to have to find a way to pay for this, surely it would be the same for the water system.
We do have a massive budget surplus also, by the way. 10 yes, years ago, when this was announced, we were in the height of austerity.
Final word.
At the risk of invoking Rusaya, and I can say this from the commentary.
Never held you back before.
I can say this because I'm on the commentating benches, not on, not like Grace. I think that we should have water charges, absolutely. I was in favor of them when they were introduced. And I think, again, we're the only country in Europe that doesn't. We're under pressure from Europe. Water is a finite resource. We live in the world as it is, not as we wish it were. And what I would say to this, you know, those who approach this from a leftist ideological point of view, my point of view is that if we introduce water charges, absolutely we could look at exemptions, we could look at cuts for families and individuals who are struggling. But why on earth is it that a family in Dublin 4 or Dublin 6 with high six-figure incomes shouldn't pay for water, which again is a finite resource? I find it ridiculous.
Well, one thing that everyone's agreed is that, and the Taoiseach said this in the White House, the number one issue in Ireland is housing. And really disturbing figures came out from the CSO during the week to say that 2024, relative to 2023, the number of planning permissions issued from apartments went down from 21,000 to 13,000, a drop of 40%.
These figures, with the number of planning permissions being granted, as well as the completion figures last year and the decline, illustrate the urgent need for, you know, emergency measures, crisis measures to be introduced.
Okay, I have to admit, I do quite a lot of work with the CIF. That was Conor O'Connell there at the CIF. I do their conferences and so on. You know, houses take 2 years from conception to design to planning, and then 2 or 3 years to build, right? Apartments are particularly difficult because in a block of 40, you can't sell your first one until you've built your last one, unlike a housing estate. This is absolutely to do with the decline in the figures last year. Build to rent was stopped, which was doing 9,000 a year. Like, I'm telling you, in 2027, these figures are going to turn into a nightmare.
So housing is absolutely the government's number one priority. There is a cabinet subcommittee on housing. It is going to look at every lever it can to make sure that we're delivering more houses. And in particular, it's going to look at the blockages in accessing things like utilities, like water, like electricity. The Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, and all of the key members in cabinet are very focused on this issue. there may be some fluctuations, but we have seen things like the development levy waiver and the water connection rebate really help kickstart a greater commencements. We saw 69,000 commencements last year, and that really is building a pipeline, and we should see delivery of those houses on the market in the next year or two.
But the reality is, when you look at apartments, Dundrum, so old shopping centre, 650 units refused planning permission. Even worse, Clonliffe, nearly 1,600 units granted by the board, turned down by on judicial review because of one religious objector living in Fox Rock. I mean, we've got to take on this issue, surely.
Yeah, and look, we will see the Planning Act be commenced in phases this year. I mean, once we see how things wash through, but we are very much hopeful that the Planning Act really will improve things in relation to planning and bring greater clarity and consistency.
Ruth, are you fearful?
Well, I'm fearful that the housing crisis is getting worse and it isn't a priority for the government, clearly, because they would have taken the measures that are needed. We all know the Taoiseach had a great laugh with Donald Trump about this as well. But I just want to say, we keep hearing planning rules are the problem. Planning rules weren't the problem 10 years ago when houses were flying up, or 12 or 13 years ago when houses were flying up left, right and centre during the boom, right? The problem is this, that the government has decided that public house building is not going to be a focus. We had the Taoiseach saying we want to pivot to the private sector. The Irish Times reported that 5,000 social and affordable houses are stalled due to lack of funding. In my own area, in Fingal, there's a huge land bank that the council has in the Dublin 15 area that they have said could build 7,000 homes, but it's on the long-term strategy. So we can keep talking about more rebates, more incentives for the private sector, and I know you're involved in that, Ivan. But the reality of it is the government should be focusing on the needs of ordinary people, affordable housing, because much of what the private sector is building is built to rent and very expensive and very costly.
Larry, it seems to me that, you know, this is a real problem for the incumbent government. If the 300,000 houses promised in the programme for government don't happen, and, you know, the CSO will record it as a matter of fact, it's really a real political dilemma for the re-election of this government.
100% it is. And I think the government's acutely aware of that. That's why I would agree with a lot of what Ruth said, but I would disagree when she says that housing isn't a priority for the government. It has to be. They would be damn fools if it wasn't. But what I would say, and again, is that it's just not good enough. It just isn't good enough. And I'd say that with respect to Grace as a member of government party and all the challenges that are in here. And I say that with due respect to you, who knows a lot of the challenges that builders face. But the bottom line is, politically, morally, and in every level, it is just not good enough that we aren't building houses. And this cuts across a whole range of different areas where our population has expanded exponentially, and we just haven't done enough to meet the demand that's there.
Sarah, you know, some of the decisions like rent regulation are going to be difficult. Facing down objectors is going to be difficult. Do you think there's the political will to deliver this?
Well, if this government's priority is housing, like the last government's priority was housing, this is a very inefficient government, and because it's just not being delivered. And, you know, like, say even like homelessness, for example, like the political will, they're not even setting a target whereby they're going to eradicate homelessness anymore. Like, it's in the programme for government, but then James Brown went back on it and he kind of said, listen, we'll get around to it at some point, was essentially the message he gave. You know, like, governments have done this in the past. Governments have solved housing crisis. Finland recently did it, and now there's issues breeding there again. But, like, it is possible to do, but it is a matter of political will. I don't really know if the political will is there. On paper, we're hearing that it is, and everyone's insisting that it is. But if it was, like, you know, 5 years, we are 5 years on from 2020 when this was still as much of a prevalent issue. Why aren't we halfway to fixing it? You know, like, it's kind of unfathomable, really.
Ivan, right. Why aren't they sitting down with all the local authorities on a weekly basis and say, why aren't you developing that land bank? What is the situation with funding? Fingal County Council, for example, has a huge amount of cash itself. that it could actually be used.
And in fact,
my
it's
opinion.
Down to the AHBs, the Clwyds and Responds, who've actually delivered the numbers, not the local authorities. They've absolutely failed. We'll have a bit of fun for the last few minutes. Who's going to be our next president? Here's an applicant.
If I was asked to consider running for the presidency by people who are in a position to allow me to be a candidate, I would consider it very, very carefully.
That was Senator Michael McDougall. Larry, who do you think? Like, obviously, we have a situation of a United Left opposition candidate. I think a key factor here is you don't get your expenses back unless you get 12.5% of the vote, the final vote. So, who do you think will win?
Who do I think will win? That's a look, this race is going to be very, very interesting to watch. And there's some very interesting candidates. Again, whoever emerges from the United Left will be a very strong candidate. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, where they move in this, I'm not sure. Will Sinn Féin be part of this sort of United Left candidate? Will they put their weight or will they back their own runner? Look, it's very, very hard to know. I don't like making political predictions. I will say that, for instance, people like such as Mairead McGuinness would be a very formidable candidate. Were she to run, I think whoever emerges as the United Left candidate could emerge. I think that they will be in very good position. And what I'm hearing from a lot of people is perhaps the next president of Ireland is somebody whose name is not yet on the lips of insiders.
But who might that be?
I don't know.
Grace, what's your take on it?
Well, there are no candidates yet. So,
do you think Fine Gael will put forward a candidate?
Well, I would certainly like to see Mairead McGuinness or Frances Fitzgerald. I think they'd be two excellent candidates. Both have phenomenal experience and I think they would represent Ireland very well. So I'd be very supportive of either of those.
Not a joint Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil regional independent candidate, no?
Well, we'd have to see who that might be.
OK, there was a meeting last week of all the left parties, Sinn Féin, Ivana Bacek, Sock Dems, yourselves, People for Profit. Do you think there will be a unified candidate of the left?
I wasn't actually involved in the meeting because People for Profit and ourselves are obviously different entities, but okay. One alliance. But, you know, I'm very open to hearing about a left candidate, obviously. The presidency isn't something that I'm particularly engaged with because I don't know if we need a president, to be absolutely frank, in such a small country. But I don't think somebody like Michael McDougall or maybe some of the names mentioned, like somebody who's been an architect of, you know, very right-wing policies,
would, be a good
would
thing
not
to
get
have,
elected.
Yeah. Sarah, what do you think?
I actually find this deeply fascinating, what's going to happen. So it's kind of funny in that this is like a kind of real-time example of speculation fueling the news cycle, which is just fuels speculation even further.
Like, where do we get to the silly season?
I know. but it's, it's really interesting. I think that I was talking to people on the left. They don't really seem to have a candidate in mind. There's no one in mind. Roisin Shortall, has essentially ruled herself out.
Yeah, she won't. I hear it's Catherine Connolly or
Frances Black's name actually came from Sinn Féin's camp, which is really interesting. So I think they could, whether they decide to back the left-leaning candidate, which is looking quite likely at the minute, because it came from Sinn Féin originally, the name Frances Black, she could be a very, popular contender in that base. Just on Michael McDougall, I know he's saying he'll consider it, but also he is such a legal eagle. Is he a real, is he a diplomat? I don't know. Like, would he want to go around representing Ireland on the world stage?
Well,
I don't know.
Ultimately, it'll be a matter for the voters. I'd like to thank our Friday Forum panellists. You heard lastly there from Sarah McGuinness, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. You heard from Grace Boland, Fine Gael TD for Fine Gael West, Ruth Coppinger, of People, TD, People for Profit Solidarity from Dublin West, and Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at the University of Galway.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.